to the Danielle Strickland Podcast. We're glad you're here. For more information on what Danielle does, go to daniellestrickland.com.
Welcome.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, people. We're glad you're here. Welcome to the mind-blowing books that we love and hate. It's complicated.
Lots of books.
Although so far it's all been love.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Although I guess some of them are so challenging, sometimes it can be...
That's true. They've made my life more difficult by knowing they exist.
Right.
I feel that. So to say I hate them is not fair, but in the same way that people... Elizabeth, hate like a personal trainer. You know what I mean?
This is always complicated. It's complicated. I put that word in there because my husband doesn't like it. And so we're not allowed to use it in our house unless we're talking about the devil or sin.
Oh.
But it's too strong of a word, he says.
It is too strong.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I did it anyway. So there.
There's no books on this list about being an obedient wife. I don't know how that didn't come up.
There's still time. Okay, so we're entering into a whole new genre here called life impact. It's a little different. So up until now, we've kind of been taking our time with the books and letting them speak, kind of letting, like quoting them and just kind of letting you kind of soak in the books. This is going to be a little bit more of an overview of some books that have had life impact in our lives and maybe a bit why.
This is also, a lot of this is Danielle convincing me about why I should read these books, which is
or
okay.
Or just read other books besides theological books. That's pretty much like, James, I really appreciate the depth of your reading, but the width.
It's a real narrow.
Width,
yeah.
Come on. Anyway, we haven't even gotten into novels yet because James hasn't read any.
I read a novel in 2015 and it was pretty good. I enjoyed it. Yeah,
and I was told by a really good writer communicator that the best thing you could do if you're a communicator is to read novels because it's the art of storytelling.
Yeah.
Right. Like the more you immerse. Now, we also have other ways. We do Netflix and movies and stuff, which, by the way, is going to be a season we're going to come up with later. So stay tuned if you want to learn all about Squid Games and what it might mean and Marvel concepts and all kinds of, anyway, we got stuff on the go. So don't miss out on that. But this one is Life Impact. So Cry of the Urban Poor is on my list. It's by Viv Griggs. This was at a time when I was really seeking God. I was in the Downtown East Side already, trying to learn and take God up on his invitation in solidarity with oppressed people and just trying to deconstruct my privileged life and learn about Jesus from the margins.
So was that early enough in your life that you thought you knew everything, or had you already realized that you didn't know anything by that point?
Oh yeah, like I think I pretty much thought I knew everything.
Okay.
Like for a long time and still probably struggle with that.
That was like last year for you.
Thanks for bringing that up, James. But I think I was, when you get to a place like the Downtown East Side, you do. It is.
Can you just explain that briefly for folks, like my friends in England that might not?
Yeah.
Know
so it's
exactly
Canada's poorest postal code. It's a containment area of drug addicts. So there's about 8,000 injecting drug users, although they're dying in unprecedented numbers right now. But, and it's like there's seven blocks in one of Canada's wealthiest cities, but these seven blocks kind of contain, and there's this like agreement that like they can use drugs there as long as they don't leave the neighborhood. So the idea is to contain infectious diseases. It's really the health emergency overrided sort of this idea of violence. And so there's just a lot of pain there. There's also a lot of God there for sure, but there's a lot of pain there. So that's probably, I went there to bring Jesus there and then discovered he was there waiting for me to get there so he could teach me some things. So that's
Jesus
probably when
really
I
really been doing some stuff in the neighborhood before you arrived.
It's
Danielle.
Shocking.
That
I know. It's crazy. So, the nerve didn't even wait for me. So, the Cry of the Urban Poor is kind of like that experience, but like global picture. And he basically says, like, everybody says, like, they want to win the world for Jesus. You know, we want global evangel, like all these things, but no one actually will care for the urban poor, which is most of the world. So he kind of breaks down this point. Like, so even in like, you know, parts of the world that are underdeveloped, like even there, he said the church planting strategy is to go to the middle class or the upper middle class, because it's the only way that you can fund your church. And he said that the real message of Jesus, of course, is to go to the poor, and all the poor are in these urban centers and largely forgotten by the church.
Yeah.
So he makes this beautiful, beautiful case that's both passionate, both biblical, but it's also this like kind of just pragmatic strategy. Like, do you or do you not want to reach the majority of people with the gospel? Because if you do, you're missing them, you know? And I thought that was really, anyway, that was a life shifting book for me.
It's interesting. You're right. The amount of church plants you see in suburban areas, and even the kind of the way the church planting movement exploded, was the suburbanization of middle class people who wanted to get out of the downtown where there were scary
and then church
people.
Growth strategies are all like, what's the most sustainable?
Mm.
And you're like, no, that what? That's not the question.
Created an idol of sustainability and surviving.
Yes.
Like, why is that such an idol for Christians in church, do you think? Because like Jesus wasn't very good at it. Nor most of his disciples.
Right. I mean, in the long term, it was a pretty successful movement.
Yeah.
But in the short term, not so much, right? So I think also, I think the obvious cultural normative, you know, so we buy into the culture, like Eugene Peterson says in Romans 12 in the Message version, right? Like, don't let culture conform you or squeeze you into its mold. Hmm. I think the church gets squeezed into a mold and because it makes sense, you know, this makes sense. You want to get people to go to church who can tithe and go to the places where there's people who can tithe that go to your, you know, and sustainability and parking and like all the things. So what's really been cool for me is like, I've been in places where people are like, if we really want to impact the world, we've got to get to the most influential people.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'll just hear Viv in my mind.
Mm.
Right. Like I'll just hear him in my, like that plan, even that pragmatic. I'm like, I don't think that's actually the way to get to the world.
Yeah.
I think the urban poor are like, I'll have him. Anyway. So what I mean by life impact is I can't shake that even pragmatic idea of like, where is the church going? Why are we going there? What is our aim? Why are we aiming for it? And are we really doing what it is we say that we're trying to do?
It's interesting that in the life of Jesus, who again is always so brilliant and eloquent and has the right thing to say and, you know, converts people and convinces people and does all these things, when he finally finds himself in an audience with Pilate, with the most powerful person in the area, he just stands there.
He says nothing.
Left nothing. Like, you don't really have any power, and I don't need to convince. Like, even the word there where he says, you know, are you the king of the Jews? Is as you've said. The better translation there is literally like, you are talking. Like, you have said words. Like, that's, isn't that curious that if that was the goal, then hey, he's got his audience with a sympathetic person in power that wants to be compelled. And like, no. You're not who I'm here. You're not the person I'm here to convince.
Interesting. So that was a big one. And then I think I was thinking about life impact, and I was thinking like a lot of my early discipleship was through books.
Okay.
And they were almost always through biographies.
Hmm.
So for better or worse, you know, but like I remember No Compromise by Keith Green was like a biography that just like, I was like, what's happening here? And it just really like opened me up to like give it all.
Who's Keith Green? Tell me a little about Keith Green.
So Keith Green is like an early worship artist who was like on the fast track. He was like actually a contemporary of Donny Osmond. And they were both kind of like going for secular music. And he got radically saved.
Oh, okay.
And then he just was like, forget that. And he would host these. He was really like created Me a Clean Heart.
Hmm.
That's Keith Green.
Oh, okay.
Or like Refiner's Fire. I think that's Keith Green. Like, You're Beautiful. You know that song? Anyway, I won't try. That's crazy. Anyway, he wrote a lot of really cool songs, and he was an artist. So you would come to a concert, but then the concert would turn into worship.
Hmm.
And he is he was so radically committed to Jesus. He like gave all of his stuff away. Like he would just give his records away for free, and he would preach revival at his worship and revival. Like people would start confessing and weeping, and he would like end up under the piano weeping on his face instead of playing the piano. And like, he was just like totally into it. He's married to Melody Green, and they actually were really captured the heart of William and Catherine Booth a lot. They published a lot of pamphlets with their words on it and stuff about caring for the poor. And anyways, this is like a revival artist, and he died early. He died with his son, Josiah, and he had just written a song for his son. He wrote a song called I Pledge My Head for Heaven for the Gospel. And then one of the verses says, I pledge my son to heaven for the gospel. And so it's like all this idea of like his allegiance is only to God alone. Like he'll give everything he has. And then shortly after he wrote that song, he died in a plane crash with his son.
Oh, wow.
And his impact, though, like the impact of his life and his words, you know, just still, like, I think people around the world are still impacted by him. So that was impacting to me. Jackie Pullinger's story, Chasing the Dragon. If you don't know that, she's a missionary that went, she was like in her early 20s, got on a boat from England, went to Hong Kong, went to the walled city in Hong Kong, which is like where all the drug addicts lived. And then God just started doing these miraculous things where he would get drug addicts off of heroin and stuff through the gift of tongues, really.
Really?
Yeah, I kind of skipped that over when I first read the book because I was like, well, whatever. Because I wasn't really from a movement that like was into that. And so I went back to it later because I actually went to visit her when I was in the downtown east side trying to minister to drug addicts and nobody was getting healed. I went to visit her to say, like, what's happening? And I remember her teaching me about this. So this is really interesting when you meet a hero, you know, so yeah. I read her book when I was like literally like 21, newly saved or whatever. And I was just like, I'm going to Hong Kong. Like, yeah. You know, I'm going to, you know. And what was cool about her actually is she had this vision of Africa. And then on the map of Africa was Hong Kong. And she said, I understood that in my mind, mission meant Africa.
Yeah.
So if God had just said, go to Hong Kong, I wouldn't have understood. But he's like, I want you to be a mission. I want you to go on mission to Hong Kong. So anyway, she's there and she's hilarious. She's like totally hilarious, James. You would love her so much. Like she's just like, she says like these missionaries, like short-term missionaries drive me crazy. She says like people who come and stay for like what, 10, 12 years and then just go home. And then she was speaking at a conference one time and she said, what is with this new Christian phrase, you look well rested? Like, or no, she said, what is with this new Christian insult, you look tired? She's like, of course I look tired. I'm serving the poor. I have drug addicts living in my living room. Like the question should be, why do you look so well rested? And just stuff like that. Like she just stirs it up everywhere she goes. But anyway, she's super cool. I love her so much. And she told me when I was visiting her, she said, why do you keep insisting on trying to reason with drug addicts? Have you ever been able to talk a drug addict out of their addiction?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. She goes, yeah, that's right. Because the problem's not in their mind. It's in their spirit. So she said, the gift of tongues is the only way I've figured out how to bypass the mind.
Oh, wow.
And just speak to the spirit. But she said to me, the reason why you guys can't stand that in the West is because actually the mind is your highest authority.
Ooh.
And I was like, ooh. I see what you mean. So she's like, all of a sudden.
Theological books, Danielle. Right. Don't take this from
so
me.
She's like, all of a sudden, because you can't understand what God is doing, yeah. It can't be God. Isn't that nice of you? So she's like, the only way to bypass the mind in my known gifts is through tongues. So I was with her. She was with all these workers of hers who were out, you know, talking, like trying to spread the word that there was hope and possibility of a future to these drug addicts. And she actually said to them, I've heard some of you are trying to talk to drug addicts. Would you please stop it? You're wasting our time. And just like, use the gifts. The spirit has to speak to them. We cannot do it. So anyway, she's always in my head. Always, always.
Yeah.
What else is on here? Have you read any of those books?
Actually, hey, look, I'm pretty pleased to say there's actually a couple of books here I have read. Pagan Christianity is an interesting one. Pagan Christianity, which came out, I feel it came out about 10, 15 years ago. I don't know, it was very, it was recommended, actually, our good friend Quincy, who is
Quincy,
a teacher at the Meeting House. He said, James, please don't read this book. So naturally, I went out and grabbed it and read it immediately. That's the surefire way of ensuring. Recommending a book is a good way to make sure I don't read it. But saying I shouldn't read something is...
Oh, you should have told me that earlier.
Yeah, I know, right? If you'd like to not recommend some fiction books to me, okay. I'm game for that too. Pagan Christianity, really, it's a hard read and it's an interesting read. And he spends a lot of time, it's by Frank Viola and George Barna. And they're involved in really lots of even surveys, right? And asking what is relevant.
Kind of the church people, growth, yeah. The church growth kind of people lots back of in the day.
So, but the book Pagan Christianity goes into the pagan roots of a lot of what we consider to be, you know, holy or Christian or churchy.
Right.
And it really breaks down. It's, again, it's a fun, light read, actually, but also weighty and punchy.
And it's so kind of shocking.
It's also like, so just so we're clear, everything about the church, so unless you're just gathering in someone's living room for food, it's probably pagan. Like, those are the most basic.
So pagan Christianity leads us on a fascinating tour through church history, revealing the startling and unsettling truth. Many cherished church traditions embraced today originated not out of the New Testament, but out of pagan practices. One of the most troubling outcomes has been the effect on average believers, turning them from living expressions of Christ's glory and power to passive observers. If you want to see that trend reverse, turn to Pagan Christianity, a book that examines and challenges every aspect of our present-day church experience. This book shocked me. And I mean, I thought I already kind of knew some of the things. Like, so if you're sitting there going like, yeah, Christmas tree is like a pagan.
Oh, I'm so edgy.
Yeah, I thought I knew that too. And then I read this book and was like, wow.
The even the architecture of the church, for example, is so they're quite mean about church buildings, and they're mean, they're kind of, well, again, not mean, they're deconstructive about everything, and the kind of follow-up reimagining church is really important to read, because pagan Christianity does a lot of deconstruction, which is all good, but if you don't build something better in its place, then you're just exposed to the elements, and that's not good either. But there are some fun pieces in there. But one, they talk about the church building in particular. One of the lines from it, it's a bit of a finer point on it. The church building is based on the benighted idea that worship is removed from everyday life. Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of, even thinking like that, was so important to me and quite foundational to me, that one of the things that we kind of hold on to, one of the people they quote is Tertullian, who we mentioned in an earlier episode,
African.
An early African theologian, and one of, certainly in the third century, probably the most influential theologian. So many of his ideas have endured. But he has this line that says, custom without truth is error grown old.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So what do you do?
Well, even these subtitles are punchy. And actually what they had to do is they had to follow up with another book, because it left people so like discombobulated and worried. So like, here's the sermon,
Protestantism.
Most sacred cow, right? And they just talk about how, and actually my husband does this a lot. The only time preaching is used in the scriptures is when they're telling the gospel to unsaved people. There's no preaching to church people. That doesn't happen. They devote each other to the teaching and to bread and to prayer.
Yeah.
There's no that sermon is like a Roman style lawyer kind of presentation. It's not Christian.
It's hard. I mean, and they're quite, I read
says
this
the teacher.
One. Yeah.
Here's another subtitle. The pastor, obstacle to every member functioning.
Yeah. Like they don't, and I.
And even again, pastor is not used in the scripture. The word pastor one time is used. And even when it's used of the people, not of the person. So like the idea of an office
context.
Of pastor has no, that's not what it means.
And so
and
they take the kind of, and they talk about the sung worship side of things. Yeah,
yes.
The building itself, the architecture. Tithing is one of the things. I remember they go after tithing.
Yeah.
How that looks different. So
tithing and clergy salaries.
Yep. If
they quote Paul, unlike so many, we do not peddle the word of God for profit. I don't even know how these guys survived this book. But this was a shocker. And if it's not... they do follow it up with basically what they say is like home church is the answer.
Yeah, yeah.
In the end, their second book, I forget what it's called.
Reimagining Church, isn't it?
Reimagining Church. So there's a second book to this, and it's meant to go together. So it doesn't just like deconstruct you without any reconstruction. But I think their ending place was we need to rediscover home church.
Yeah.
I'd say that's probably where I land most of the time anyway.
Certainly if you're not involved in some sort of close community, where you can share life and share faith, that is going to be, you're going to be very limited. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. And I don't even think it's limitations for the people that gather in the church. I think it's also like, it's where all the issues of power are manifested is when the church orchestrates like that. There's no, when you're meeting in a living room, all of those issues of who belongs and who doesn't and who can lead and who can't lead and who can preach and who can, it's all doesn't matter anymore. You're just like all in the living room discovering God together. So I feel like, I think some of that a lot of that, like the way we've orchestrated church has so much power structure, which is pagan, which I think is part of the problem. So sometimes I feel like to deconstruct it, to try to do that institutional power structure in a kingdom way is maybe too hard. I don't know. I mean, you know, but I lean in that direction.
It's hard. It also, like, it removes the ego part of it. And I know it. And right. Maybe you've been doing it longer than me. Maybe you don't feel that anymore.
Right.
But yeah, there's, and in a living room, when you say something profound, people are like, oh, that's, you know, that's nice. And
yeah.
Then, but
or
then,
where's the coffee?
And then, yeah, all that, yeah, either they love it and more conversation follows. Right. So it kind of gives birth to something.
Yeah.
Or people start caring, like, oh, I thought it was interesting, but I guess you don't. Whereas when you're on stage, there is this kind of expectation that everything you say is going to be this brilliant, profound thing. So if it's not, it's like devastating. Yeah.
And even state, like even the, I know I can't even remember who did this, but he did like a theology of screens. So even being on a stage and then being on a screen, he does this whole thing about like how to be larger than life is to be like, you know, presented as something you aren't even in the moment. Like yeah. You're not, you do not look like that. You're on a screen. Like this is something else. So anyway, I think it's that the pagan Christianity, if you're, oh, reimagined church, there it is. Yeah. If you're looking for two books to help you sort of, if you're deconstructing, they will help you, I think, rediscover what's really essential about Jesus.
And I think it is clear that they do care too. Mm-hmm. It's not a slam piece for the sake of it. I think it's a,
yeah.
Do you feel like something is missing, or do you feel like something's broken, or do you feel like things are wrong? Well, that's probably because you've read the Bible and or have like a relationship with God where you're hearing about this desire for intimacy that I think can be experienced in that corporate setting, but needs more too.
Yeah. And it's actually just good. I think it's good awakening. Just, it's good to be curious about some things. Mm. And I think there is a really good posture to go like, whoa, yeah. I did not know. I think that's just good.
It might blow your mind, which is the point.
Okay. A couple other books here. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger was a classic for me. That's by Ron Sider. It's a classic. If you haven't read that, it's kind of one of those ones that everyone knows they should read and hasn't read.
I will put my hand up and say, wonderful listeners, I have not read this book.
But I think Ron Sider, just sort of wrestling through, like, what are we doing? We are the wealthiest people in the world. I mean, we're in the top 3% of the wealthiest people, even those of us who think we're not that wealthy. We are. We're super wealthy. And so what do we do with that? And how do we live in such a way that's faithful to God and faithful to the poor? And of course, his calling is to like stop hunger. Like the answer is to like share. And so if you don't want that as an answer, but it's a robust, good look, honest look, open look. Okay. And rather than just like pretending like it's not a thing, I think it's important to make that I think that's one of the most important things that we can figure out, because we are the rich Christians. So how we live is going to matter. The Jesuit Guide to Everything. Have you read that by James Martin?
I have not, no.
So
tell me, as a non-Jesuit yourself and as a non-Jesuit myself, why would I count the Jesuits, I got to say, Danielle?
Okay, well, what's cool about this book is like I found it in Indigo. Like okay. It's just in that, like it's in mainstream culture. And actually James Martin, he is a Jesuit. And but he's like speaks a lot to popular culture. Like he's the guy they call if they want to hear from like a priest. They call him.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool. So he's written this in mind with like people who are struggling or searching. This is the Jesuit's guide. And the big takeaway, it's very fascinating to read just more of the Jesuits. But one of the things I didn't really realize, but that I see now after reading that book that is so powerful, is that the Jesuits believe that everything is a path. You're on a path. Everyone's on a path to Christ, whether they know it or not. Everything's a path.
Awesome.
So your desires are a path. Like so rather than go like your desires are bad, you shouldn't lust for sex or whatever like that. They'll say, no, follow that desire to its root.
Okay.
What do you really want? So what they'll say is like your desire for sex is actually a desire for connection.
Sure.
And that desire is actually leading you to God. And they'll say that they'll say even atheism is a path to God. They'll say that even atheism, this like denial that there's some, is this like underneath, it's this like actual need for like certainty or whatever, like, and you're actually longing for something. So they, and that was, I thought like, whoa, that is a powerful thought. Because if you think, instead of thinking of things as bad or good, you actually think of things as an invitation, like things as like a way to communicate this need for God It's kind of a powerful way of approaching life.
It becomes a lot easier to kind of reckon with the pieces of ourselves and the choices that we've made that we're less proud of or less happy about as well, rather than be like, that was my sinful self. And then you just cut it off and you remove it without actually asking, well, what is the brokenness here? What is the hurt here? And when we meet and see and be around really broken people, you recognize, well, yeah, there may be some bad choices along the way there, but what is the cry there? Mm-hmm. What is the real desire? And you know, the amount of time is like, I just want and spending time with folks who are, street involved individuals, a lot of the time they're addicted to drugs is because it's minus 10 degrees and they want to get some sleep. And you go, well, I kind of want sleep too. It's just, I don't need to be doing.
Or they're isolated. They have no community, no connection.
Yeah.
And they're medicating themselves. I mean, on and on this goes, right? Like, to trace your desire to its source, yeah. I think is how the Jesuits might say it. And I just, even for evangelism, that's mattered a lot to me. Mm. Like, look for the desire.
Yeah.
Don't like come with the answer to a question they don't have. Look for, where is the longing? Where's the desire? Where's that, like, what are they looking for? And that desire is actually God's invitation for them to follow it to its source.
Yeah.
And I'm just, anyway, that was the most powerful takeaway for me in the Jesuits' Guide to Everything. Plus, it's a fun read. So what's another one? I think Brené Brown did a couple that I think are pretty, I think she's shifted culture in a way, just talking about shame and vulnerability and leading in different ways. I think Brené Brown's a really powerful influence. I really liked her vulnerability and leadership. Her latest book is really, really helpful. It's research-based, and it makes a lot of sense. And then also, if you don't know, Brené Brown is a Christian and an AA-er. You know, I like this combination is something I like because he's a Christian who tells the truth, which basically that's what that says. And then also this, like, researcher. So it has this kind of mixture of all these beautiful things, and it makes her a very powerful force of truth. So I recommend her. I wanted to mention, too, Blueprint for the Revolution.
Okay? Yes.
All right, so
Danielle's been pretty hype on this book for a while. I'm going to tell you, when we first started this was one of the first books that she grabbed out and was excited by.
Yeah, this is Popovich, okay? Popovich is a Serbian political activist and executive director of the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. It's called Canvas. He was a leader of the student movement OPTPAR, which helped topple Serbian president Slobodan Milosevic. He has taught at the Harvard Kennedy School, NYU, and the University of Colorado, among others, and he lives in Belgrade. Okay, so this is it. Blueprint for Revolution. Here's a subtitle, okay, guys? How to use rice pudding, Lego men, and other nonviolent techniques to galvanize communities, overthrow dictators, or simply change the world. And this is
a Banksy picture on the front, which immediately endears me.
Yes. And this book is so powerful because, I mean, he's not just giving you theory. He's telling you how they did it, like how a group of students overthrew a dictator.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about Lima Bowie doing that in Liberia and stuff. And then what he did was he just took the principles that worked for them and he teaches them now. So they have, you know, people from Egypt that came for him for training to say, like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And they're just these hilarious stories. They're just really funny and very practical. So he says, like, even if you're doing like a mass protest, put the women at the front.
Yeah.
They're less likely to be violent. He said, like, women are less likely to be the, but if you put like these young kids at the men at the front that are all like wanting to prove their ego, you're going to have a violent outbreak. Mm. So he goes, you're going to train everyone in nonviolence. You're going to put the women at the front because the police are less likely to be violent to them and they're less likely to retaliate. So your chances are higher. And then he even talks about how, well, he talks about how like people come saying like, I can't do that, thinking that they have to be special. And then one of his big things is to debunk that myth. Like, I'm not, look at me, I'm not special. And I did it. You know what I mean? Like, I was part of something. And so then he just really, and the other thing I really love about him is he uses humor. He talks a lot about humor.
Okay.
And how, as kind of almost as a prophetic witness, like humor as a way of poking fun at, you know, poking fun at power.
Yeah.
Using sort of humorous, almost like theater in a way.
Mm.
So they did this, I can't remember the name of the car. I have to look at it again, but they did this ping pong ball protest. And he said, it's hilarious because they just took like all of these ping pong balls and they like wrote like a word on them. Like, I forget what the word was, but it was like the word like for freedom or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they were like in a regime that was like, you're not allowed to protest. And these people just kept dropping ping pong balls everywhere with this word on it. And then like the king or the president or whatever is like, go get those ping pong balls. And then he said like everybody watched and took phone footage of all these police trying to catch ping pong balls. And he said it was hysterical. It like made on the news and it just like made this regime look ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he said, and that was the point of the protest, is this oppression is ridiculous. Yeah. That's what it is. So he just like, you know, I mean, he's just so full of story. I highly recommend it. It's not a Christian book. There's some swear words in here. He's not a Christian, although he's a big fan of Lord of the Rings, which is interesting because it's kind of Christian, isn't it? Come on, people.
It's pretty Christian.
And and he just has really like, this is what you do. When I read this book, I just was like, okay, we're doing it. Let's change the world. It's one of those books. It just stirs you up because it's real and he's doing it.
I do want to start a revolution. So
yes, I'm the garage.
Okay. Yeah. So this is
halfway there.
This is a place where all the things happen. Yeah.
And also like students, no money, you know, they use, and actually Serbia, that particular movement used rock and roll because the president had banned rock and roll. Because it was a Western influence. And so they actually...
Is he the pastor from Footloose?
Yeah, that's right. They hosted like a big rock and roll punk party in the center of town. And that was like one of the protests. So he said, we actually made the resistance cool.
Yeah.
And he said that's one of the strategies to make the resistance cool. So anyway, that is that. What else did I want to talk about? I don't have time to talk. Oh, okay. Last two ones real quick.
Okay.
One is called The Last Emperor. And it's by a famous journalist called Kapuscinski. He's a Polish journalist. And this book is about the last emperor, Haile Selassie from Ethiopia, who was part of the longest reigning empire in history.
Yeah.
So his lineage, like the first emperor of Ethiopia, apparently is the child of Queen of Sheba and Solomon, King Solomon. So that's where the lineage begins.
It's a fairly impressive bloodline.
Yeah. And Ethiopia is like, they love they love that heritage and they love the emperor and they love the king. So like, so there were revolutions before. The king was totally like out of touch with reality. And it was just, well, we remember Ethiopia during the famine. He was a guy that led during the famine in the 70s. And it was the first time we ever saw like millions of people starving to death. It was on his watch. So they need to get rid of him and they try to do a revolution and the people killed the revolutionaries because they're like, don't touch the king.
Yeah.
And so finally they did this like revolution in the name of the king.
Oh.
and literally just walked into the palace and drove Haile Selassie in a limo to his summer home and he lived out his day. So no one really knows if like he still thinks, no one knows what happened there except that it was a bloodless revolution.
Yeah. Okay.
So what happened is afterwards, this guy goes into Ethiopia and he interviews the palace staff. And he says, tell me about Haile Selassie. And of course they love him. So they're just like, oh, he was the best. And they'll be like, you know, he saw that we weren't doing well during the famine. He saw we were like depressed. And he read in a leadership magazine that calisthenics were really helpful to perk up employees at work. So he flew in calisthenics specialists from Sweden to Ethiopia in the mornings to do 15 minutes of calisthenics before we began work to cheer us up. And like the person saying it, like, isn't he amazing? And you're like, yeah, well, he could just feed your family. Like, that's the other option. Right. So like, it's just like that. So the whole book is so brilliantly done because there are all these interviews like that are highlighting how amazing the king is, except like as you're reading it, you're like, oh my gosh, this is insane.
Yeah.
So I would say if you're looking for a leadership book, because I read that book and I was like, oh yeah. That's every bureaucracy I know, right? Yeah. Like just disconnected from what really is and like doing good things. So like we weren't questioning the motive of this guy.
Yeah.
It was just, he was so disconnected from reality that it affected the way he led. So I highly recommend The Last Emperor. It really, literally, I'm always like, am I Haile Selassie? Like, am I disconnected from reality? And the truth is yes, of course. And then the last book I just want to say is Willful Blindness. So if there are books that I talk about a lot, The Last Emperor is one and Willful Blindness is the other.
Yeah.
Margaret Heffernan wrote a book called Willful Blindness. And in that book, she talks about how our brains are wired to believe the truth we want to be true. Mm-hmm. So she said it explains social big things like Germany, you know, like Hitler's an amazing leader, even though everyone kind of knew he wasn't amazing. There was a willful blindness because they needed it to be true. They needed there to be a great leader. They needed there to be a solution. They needed Germany to rise again. So they believed it. And she said it also explains tiny things like your spouse is having an affair and you're like, I didn't know, I didn't know, I didn't know. And then you start looking back and you're like, oh, I knew, I knew, I knew. I just didn't want to know, didn't want to know, didn't want to know. Like you start remembering, like, how could I not have seen this? And she said, you can't see it because of willful blindness. That book was like life changer for me.
Okay.
Where I start, like the scales of my eyes started to come off in ways that like I was believing the truth that I wanted to be true in lots of areas of my life, with the church, with organizations, with like my own life, instead of what was really true. Mm. And the last half of that book is just a study on whistleblowers. And okay. She said, fascinatingly enough, she said, whistleblowers, you would think that they're like the outliers, like they're the mavericks of the company. And she said, every single time whistleblowers are the most dedicated ones, because she said the most dedicated ones are clearer on the mission.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that feel the dissonance between what we're saying we're doing and what we're actually doing. So she talks a lot about how whistleblowers are created. But anyway, I highly recommend that book to anyone, Willful Blindness.
We get to be whistleblowers for Christ. Is that?
Yes.
That's where we go there, right?
Yes. And also truth. We don't have to be afraid of it.
Yeah.
You know, even though our brains are wired that way, we can actually embrace the truth and the truth could set us free. Right. Mm. Yeah. So the final one, James,
yours. Well, I was looking down the list and the book that actually we read earlier was The Deeply Formed Life by Rich Velotis, which is really, I think it's kind of exploded this year, actually, and rightly so.
Yes.
We interviewed him on the last series, and he was great and is great. I think what's so interesting is that even going back over it, I'd forgotten just how rich this book is because it's so practical, right? Like in my head, like what's a good practical book for kind of rhythms? And, you know, Sabbath is something he talks about a lot, and relationships and racial reconciliation.
Emotional healthiness as a part of our spiritual journey.
Yeah, like these are really just raw, practical things. And yet there is such an undeniable richness to what he says.
He's really wise.
There's just odd lines every here and there, but like the Sabbath is not a reward for hard work. Sabbath is a gift that precedes work and enables us to work. Mm-hmm. As with God's grace, rest is never a reward. It's a gift. Mm. What a great way of thinking about things. Another one that jumped out to me. To be an incarnational follower of Christ, there must be a relinquishing of control, a reversal of the social order. According to the natural perceptions of this world, it's an upside-down kingdom. But it's a kingdom of God. God-saturated imagination. It is the way of the cross.
Mm. Yeah, we highly recommend Rich Velotis. It is I think in that last season, I said, you know, this is Richard Foster, you know, next gen.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that Celebration of Discipline book that was sort of like the book. This is this book for this generation.
That's what convinced my partner to read it. She was like,
Did she agree?
Oh, yeah, she loves it. Yeah.
It's one of those books. It's not going away. Yeah. It's a classic for a generation because he just deals. It's like that. It's like Richard Foster. Like this is evergreen for the next generation, I think.
Yeah.
So those are a few of the books that have had some life, not all of them by any means, but those are the ones that we thought we might mention. And hopefully you heard a couple that are new to you. Certainly there was a rich variety of things here, but if there's one of those books sticks out to you and you're like, you know what? I should read that book. Read it. Maybe it'll have an impact on your life too.
Right.